I'm Georgia Pavlopoulou. I work at UCL Institute of Education. I'm a research fellow at the Lifespan Learning and Sleep Laboratory here in London. I come into research after 17 years of clinical experience in both NHS and educational settings, experiencing challenges and opportunities to empower and to meaningfully engage family members in clinical planning and in therapeutic work. And that has inspired a body of research I'm doing with typically developing and autistic siblings, looking at the ways we can empower them to meaningfully shape our ideas around autism, our ideas about mental health in autism, and what types of family support we should be looking for. I was experiencing all the challenges and opportunities in educational therapy settings, in schools, in NHS settings, about how do we actually facilitate a process of change? How do we move towards a direction that is chosen by autistic people and their families and not by the experts? How do we meaningfully engage them into the decision making, into co-establishing goals and priorities for their lives? And after a few years of experience, I realized that very often we look for answers in our expert colleagues or in all these therapy intervention trainings that we have done. And we still miss the point, and we still miss to gain the voice of autistic people and their experiences, which can teach us a lot about how we can move forward. So to me, one of the ways I wanted to address this gap in my clinical practice is to go through academic research and try to find answers on how we can be better in terms of facilitating change, positive change, and facilitating a better quality of life for autistic people. I am also involved in sleep research with Dr. Dagmara Dimitriou. We have been recently being funded from the John and Lorna Wing Foundation, working with autistic teenagers, looking at their personal accounts on sleep and anxiety. This body of research have sparked a number of conversations the past 16-17 months with autistic adults, which approached us and said, so what about us? So I have been very, very lucky to be involved in a new body of research looking at autistic adults' sleep in relation to physical and mental health and feasibility interventions. It has been a great pleasure to work with Dagmara Dimitriou, who is leading the team, Cos Mikael, autistic advocate and trainer, and John Adams, artist and autistic advocate, working together with autistic people rather than on autistic people or for autistic people, to look at their sleep experiences and how these are related to their daytime functioning, and what can we do to improve sleep in order to improve quality of life. So there is a body of literature that shows that autistic people struggle with sleep, autistic people of all ages. Research has traditionally focused on children's sleep problems, and we know that up to 86% of autistic children find it hard either to fall asleep or to stay asleep during the night or to wake up and feel good, not tired. So research has focused a lot on what happens to you if you don't have a good night of sleep as a child. And sleep is very much related to memory, to learning, and to mental health and physical health. So despite the fact that we have tons of research validating the fact that sleep is important, it's very important for physical health, it's very important for mental health, we also know that autistic people don't sleep very well, we still know nothing about how the sleep problems are affecting the daytime functioning, the physical health, and the mental health of autistic adults. There is a huge gap in looking at sleep in autistic adults, And I'm particularly happy because this piece of research has been co-established with the autistic community. So what we did, it was after the momentum was created with autistic people, looking at the ways that we can explore sleep issues, we were funded by Autistica to run a survey which was co-established with two members of the autistic community, Cos Mikael and John Adams. And in only 4 weeks, we had more than 700 people responding, telling us about what their sleep is like and what are their sleep research priorities. There was a very clear need to start looking at sleep, but it was very important also to make sure that we're going to look at the right questions. And by the right questions, I mean the priorities that autistic people are setting for themselves, things that they find important. And we also run a focus group with autistic adults, Dagmar Dimitriou and I, to look at what are the possible ways that they would like to be involved. What does a sleepless night look like for an autistic person? What are the things that might facilitate a good night of sleep? You know, just to learn from the experts by experience, really, the autistic people who do have sleep issues. So we do have now research priorities, sleep research priorities. We know what autistic people would like to be researched, and we're very, very happy. The John and Lorna Wing Foundation has enabled us to go further and start addressing the research priorities of autistic people. So there is a body of research that is starting this May. We're going to look at the ways that physical and mental health is related to sleep problems. What does that mean for the everyday life of autistic people? What are the barriers and the gaps that autistic people face in the healthcare provision of sleep management for the sleep problems? And also we aim to work with autistic people and design together feasibility studies, interventions to see why it might be helpful and in which ways in terms of looking at the sleep management. I think the links between mental health, suicide rates, anxiety, they're very, very well established in the mainstream literature when we look at neurotypicals, typically developing people, and sleep. However, there is still a gap. We don't know exactly how sleep problems may interfere. For example, some autistic people have said that they have bad autism days, you know, more sensory difficulties after a bad night of sleep, post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, depression episodes might be triggered after a week of bad sleep. I think it's very, very important at that stage to look at what we know from the literature and to identify the ways that will enable us to see how we can move on. For example, we hear so many stories about autistic people who struggle to be in employment. Again, sleep is an aspect that has been totally neglected. Sleep-deprived people find it very, very hard to commit to a job. So many autistic people we know from the people who have contacted Lila's lab so far that they would prefer to find ways of being self-employed or part-time employed. I think sleep problems may link to mental health and issues of anxiety or depression in multiple ways, because it does affect the quality of your life. A bad night of sleep means that you might not be able to work, means that it might be linked to financial issues, means that you might not manage in appropriate ways, in socially expected ways, a relationship. So it might affect your social life. It means that it might exaggerate some of the sensory differences and difficulties that the person might face. And we definitely know it. There are strong links between a good night of sleep and good executive functioning, which means planning your day ahead or having good memory, functioning in daytime. So we know that sleep problems are very common in autistic children, teenagers, adults. And we also know that there are phenotypic sleep profiles. that may implicate different pathways to these sleep issues. We know from interviews and focus groups with autistic people that mainstream sleep hygiene might just not help them to deal with their sleep issues. For example, advice such as have a bath, drink your milk, or do a puzzle and go to bed might just not work for autistic people, because very often they might spend time thinking of what happened during the day or anticipating for what's going to happen the day after at school, at the workplace, in the college. It is very, very important to understand the divergent associations between sleep parameters, person characteristics, to hear from autistic people what works so far, what doesn't work, what can healthcare provision should do to facilitate a better sleep management. And our research is really looking to facilitate ways to support autism-sensitive approaches to assessment and treatment of sleep issues. Nowadays, for many pieces of research, do bits and pieces of public engagement, it is a box that autism researchers will very much find in their applications. But it is so much more than that. As you said, it's about how do we identify together with autistic people what matters to them. So instead of looking how to cure autism, how do we look at how to address issues that compromise their quality of life? And sleep is one of them. How do we identify with autistic people? What is the right question to ask? How do we plan to actively enable autistic people and their families to be part of our research? Do we create steering groups? Do we allow them to be high in the hierarchy in terms of management the research? Do we make arrangements for recognition? Do we reimburse them for the time and effort? And there's a number of issues that early career researchers like me might find in their ways. There are some bureaucratic issues with universities that might not make arrangements for payment or recognition very easy and straightforward as it should be. And on a different level, there might be difficulties working with senior people who might have been used in a more experimental, different type of work that is recognizing as experts only the scientific community, ignoring very often that autistic people and their families are experts by experience. And they can tell us very much about what they need and how they would like us to address things. And they can be involved with the right type of support into a two-way dialogue and into a research that is collaborative. I can give you an example of how I have worked with siblings, with Dagmara Dimitriou. So siblings research has been very much based on a traditional medical model of disability, very much putting emphasis on a deficit narrative. So the main research question for decades, it has been, how bad is it to have an autistic family member? How much depression, anxiety and stress is in the family members if you're raising an autistic child? The way we have approached siblings research is very much from a strengths-based approach, that is because through mixed methods and qualitative research, we noticed that typically developing siblings, they were not talking about disability and autism in the same way that the body of research is talking about them. So they were not talking about deficits, but they were talking about how much they love their siblings, their autistic siblings, how much they learn with them, a myriad of feelings, and how much pressure they feel, social pressure they feel because of lack of services, because of lack of support, because of stigma and lack of social understanding. And very often we do ask the typically developing family members, oh, what is it like to live with autism? And siblings characteristically have told me, when I was using in my early days this phrase, what is it like to live with autism? Well, I don't live with autism. I don't grow up with autism. I grow up with my brother. I grow up with my sister. So there are so many good lessons we can learn from autistic people and family members about what is it like, about the joys and the struggles. And if we unpack this with them, then we find out that much of the struggle lies within a system that does not understand, does not accept autistic people, autistic identity, and does not accommodate for them. We very often ask the typically developing family members, what is it like to have an autistic brother or sister or someone in your family? And we rarely ask autistic people, what is it like to be in this neurotypical family? What are your struggles? What are your joys? So we did involve, part of my PhD studies, it was to involve autistic children to tell us about their a sense of siblinghood, their strengths and difficulties, and how they view things from their own lens, from their own perspective. And what we found out is that, again, most of the struggle, it is related to the fact that there are no accommodations. So going back to what is important nowadays in terms of research, it is so important to enable autistic people of all ages to contribute in different ways in research. In our work with siblings, it was very important to create an equitable partnership. And that means that you have to facilitate autistic people and their families to act as co-researcher. You might train them in some research methodology. What we did, for example, with siblings, it was that we trained them in ethical ways of collecting their data. We trained them in ways that they can analyze their data, but also disseminate and communicate the data with me and Dagmara Dimitriou in order to raise awareness, to raise acceptance. So it was very, very important during all stages of research, autistic people and the families to feel empowered, not just to be participants, to be actively involved on every step of research. To learn and try. I mean, there's so much you can learn from being in contact with autistic people, being in a meaningful contact, not in a tokenistic way, but to sit down, to create relationships with autistic people, to find common pathways to work with them, to engage them, to enable them, and to recognize their efforts and times in your research projects. It can feel uncomfortable because you're moving from, you know, your comfort zone and what is already known, but it's very, very rewarding in many aspects. You might make really good friends from the autistic community. You will definitely learn a lot from autistic people and how they experience things, what really matters to them. They can be very creative in problem solving and in ways that we can move forward and engage meaningfully autistic people in our research and disseminate the results. So I would say try. Challenge a little bit your institutions, engage in conversations. And it's all about challenging ourselves as well to make the step, to connect, to trust, and to enable each other and work together.